Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Jonathan Bennett joins me. We're going to be talking about Aquameta, which is a full stack, full web stack in a database. How do they do it? We don't know. You're going to want to watch this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Jonathan Bennett. Episode 449, recorded September 6, 2017. Aquameta. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day, totally unaware of it, projects you may want to download right after this show and play with. I think today's might be one of those. I'm bringing back on my co-host, Jonathan Bennett. Welcome back to the show.
Be here once again.
Yeah, okay, good, good. And where are you speaking to us from?
I am speaking to you from the not flooded, not on fire, not in the middle of a hurricane, and no locusts, middle of Oklahoma.
Yes, yes. And I'm back in Portland, Oregon, and part of being in Portland, Oregon these couple of days has been seeing a thin layer of ash on everything. We have a huge fire, 10,000 acres and more, coming out at us from the gorge, 0% contained. And really concerning because it's such a beautiful part. You know, very many people around here are very sad because it's heading and threatening to cover up this area of the Columbia Gorge, tearing it down anyway, burning it out. That's hugely involved in tourism around here and just, you know, recreational hikes, things like that. Things that just got repaired after, you know, some money was made available a couple of years ago are on fire already. And it's just extremely sad. And the quality of the air here is a little bad. Luckily, I'm flying out of town tomorrow for 11 days. So hopefully, hopefully they don't close the airport because it's, you know, it's sort of coming towards the Portland airport. So hopefully I can get out on an early flight tomorrow and I don't have to deal with anything else. But anyway, so it's extremely sad. But I am in my home of Beaverton, Oregon, in my extremely plain wall behind me, not much to see. If I turn the camera around the other way, you would see all sorts of crap all over the floor. So that's why I never point the camera in that direction. It's cluttered. There's no organic material there, unlike other people I know. It's just cluttered. It's just a lot of things in the wrong places. So anyway, today's project, today's thing is Aquameta. Aquameta is a little hard to describe, except that it's building a web stack. Eric Hansen, the guest that's coming on today, has built a web stack entirely using Postgres. And this is, at first glance, this seemed crazy. And then I'm looking at the tech demos for it, where interactively he's changing SQL and diagrams are changing to map into that and the queries being run live. But the entire web stack is in Postgres. And I love Postgres. It's a very, very high performance, mature, amazing database. It's something everybody should reach for whenever they have to have a relational database rather than Maria or any of the other ones. It's definitely, it's been called the Oracle killer just because it's so good. You know, it's extremely mature, well-tested. You can even get it in Amazon Cloud and things now. So all cool stuff. So, Jonathan, what do you want to say about this so far?
Well, I find it very interesting. It kind of reminds me of the whole turtles all the way down. In this case, we'll say it's Postgres all the way down. I am curious, though, there has to be, in thinking through it, there's got to be just a little bit of bootstrap code somewhere that, you know, breaks out of Postgres to make things at least initially happen. So I'm very interested to hear about that, you know, how they bootstrap it to make this work. I know very little other than that. Looking forward to learning about it.
Yeah, I've been stabbing at the website this morning trying to figure out where all the pieces are and how they all fit together. But, you know, we do have an expert on that. Eric Hansen, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
And where are you speaking to us from?
Also, likewise, the smog-filled apocalypse that is Portland, Oregon right now.
Okay, I'll wave in your general direction here. So it's right over that way. So there you are. And as I was noting in our chat earlier, that you are appropriately on Ash Street.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. It is literally
good timing.
Yeah, today.
Good timing of that. So give us the 30,000 foot view. How well did I describe it from a top level? And well, you describe it in your own words.
Yeah, no, you did great. I mean, from a technological frame, that's exactly that, exactly accurate. It is a web stack built entirely in Postgres. The idea behind it, the motivation is that databases are really good at organizing things, and this process of bringing things into the database has been profoundly successful historically in other industries. Like I use the word datafication, which is kind of a goofy buzzword, but looking back at the progression of the industry, we have datafied countless, like Uber is the datafication of the taxi system, right? Craigslist is the datafication of the classified ads. Napster is the datafication of the mixtape. But when we look at the chaos that we have kind of managed with databases and the coherence that we brought into those different spheres, one central anomaly stands out that is still quite chaotic, and that is our own tools, the programming industry itself. That the web stack, in my opinion, is a giant mess of unnecessary complexity, and it has structure. And the idea is to use the database to organize that mess, just like we have organized countless other messes in throughout the history of the industry.
So, what does the structure of this actually look like?
Jonathan, you were right that there is a small amount of bootstrapping code. Everything in Postgres, there are 8 different schemas, each one that kind of roughly corresponds to a layer of a typical web stack. Version control, we re-implemented Git, but for versioning rows instead of the database instead of files in the file system. There's an event layer that taps into a WebSocket, and so we use Postgres's notify feature to like be able to subscribe to a table and then receive events when a row in that table changes, or a field or a column. It's a pub-sub system, and you say, I want to watch this particular row or this particular table entirely for inserts and deletes, and then those changes are piped over a WebSocket and then sent up to the browser. So that you can, it's kind of like lots of people do this. It's like Meteor has an event layer like that. There's a bunch of other ones, but what else? There is a writable system catalog that allows you to do Postgres administration, but using data manipulation instead of these arcane create schema, blah, 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 alter table, alter role, all that stuff that I always forget. Instead, you just use insert, update, and delete. And then you can do these operations using the same normal table structure as you usually do with regular data. They're updatable views. What else is there? There's a widget framework that allows you to. So in the database, there's a table called widget, which has fields of CSS, JavaScript, and HTML, and those are combined and composed like little Lego blocks in the browser. To create a very modular, interactive user interface component. What else is there? There's, I should know this. There's 4 more.
Well, you're not supposed to memorize it, but you probably wrote all of it, right, or most of it?
Yeah. Me and a team. But yeah. Oh, and the web server, of course. So. We use Nginx on the front end, which is a great, robust web server. We actually tried implementing our own web server in C as a background worker in Postgres, but reinventing HTTP server didn't seem like a great use of everybody's time and money. So we just used Nginx on the front. But what it does is a very thin layer that kicks off to a requests procedure in Postgres, and then everything is handled within Postgres. We parse the URL in Postgres. We kick off the request to whether it's a REST API hit or a call to pull down a resource. Then those resources are stored in the database as well. And so it's like 99% Postgres. Everything that, I mean, we could have done 100%, but it was like, what's that saying about a foolish consistency or something like that, the Hobgoblin. We're trying to not do that, but yeah, it's all in Postgres. And
don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. That's exactly. Another way to put that. Yeah, you don't have to have 100% of this thing. So what's motivating this? I mean, it's a beautiful vision, and it'll still take you a long time until you can call it a 1.0 probably. But yeah, is this something you're building for a client?
No, it's self-funded. It's about 4 years ago, we finished up a really big job for a really big client, and I was sitting on a bunch of money and owned a house. And 4 years later, none of those things are true. But yeah, it's been a self-funded like this transition from having an idea or an insight to having an invention to having a business around it. We're at the we have an invention stage right now, and my hope was that we could get funded for having an invention, but in talking to most VCs I've talked to, that's not realistic. So we have to get users. So now we're reaching out to the open source community and saying, hey, you know, we need help with this thing. We need developers hacking on it and people that are willing to tolerate some 0.1 level, quality of code and documentation in exchange for the claim that I think we kind of cracked the atom of programming complexity here. And it's going to, to make the bold claim, it necessitates a complete rethinking of all software that's ever been programmed because the file system is a bad way to organize software. It's an assumption, you know, that we organize things in the file system that dates back to the beginning of Unix in the 60s and the 50s, you know, and that the tyranny of the file system has never been overthrown, and that's what we're trying to do because it's, you know, the file system is a hierarchical structure that doesn't have all the amazing features that a database has, and it's still the state of the art of programming today. And, you know, organizing things in hierarchical trees, you know, there's a reason why we don't still use file cabinets. Like the word file is from the file cabinet, you know, and we don't use file cabinets to organize information anymore. We use databases, and yet programming is still like that. So the claim is that we can vastly reduce the complexity of software design and increase the span of reusable components. Modularity, and the software that has the least bugs is an old Steve Jobs quote. Forgive me, but like the software that has the least bugs, the software that takes the least time to use is the software where you never had to write a line of code. And today we end up redoing the same problem over and over and over. And a more modular, reusable component structure would make software programming a lot easier. So that's what we're trying to do.
So we have this wonderful demo video of some of the stuff that's already working, apparently, or unless it's all canned. I don't know how canned this demo was. But
none of it's canned. It's not all open source, but none of it's canned.
So what we're looking at here on the screen for people who have only the audio version of this is we're looking at a very beautiful set of displays and widgets, and you're running an SQL query in the top window, and it's graphically being represented as a join in the middle window, and we're looking at the result of the query down at the bottom. So you must have built in an SQL parser. Are you parsing SQL with SQL?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. We represent the SQL grammar. We use a slightly simplified SQL grammar, and under the hood, there's this whole grammar pipeline where the EBNF of the SQL grammar is represented as tables in the database, and then you can read and write to those tables, and like you can do a two string to get the query out, and you can do a data manipulation to make changes to that query, very granular changes. And so when you use that interface, it is going into this table that mirrors the EBNF of our SQL grammar and making tiny little data updates. So it's actually really simple to program this thing. And it's a, It's a general purpose pipeline that allows us to do this. We can import an eBNF and then automatically generate all these tables and then, get a visualization of it and very trivially build user interfaces to it that are bidirectional so that when you change the UI, it changes the tables and then the string changes. And when you change the string, it changes the tables and then the interface changes. It's bidirectional, which as far as I know is not super common. But like datafying the grammar of SQL itself is what allowed us to do this.
And we're also looking, for those, again, who are on audio, you're missing out. You really need to look at the video on this thing, or just go to his website because this demo video is there. We're also looking at a very beautiful, rich UI. Did you build that from scratch too?
Yeah.
What? Tell me more about that. What is that?
That's the database represented as a sphere or as great circles on a sphere. So every single table is like the underlying structure of a database schema is graph like in that every single table can foreign key to every single other table in the entire schema. And right. Graphs, like one of our inventions was that graphs can be represented as spheres rather than usually you see the points and lines that connect all the nodes and edges. Representing it as a sphere allows it to be continue to get denser. This is kind of nerdy, but like the properties of a great circle is that every great circle on a sphere crosses every single other great circle exactly mm-hmm. twice, once on each side, no matter what direction you look at it from. And so we can represent a graph as a sphere, and it's marginally useful. But it's really pretty fun to mess with, you know.
And then the rest of the demo actually goes on to show building an actual web page, building one of these widgets using the system itself. That is so meta, so insane. Yeah. So you have widgets giving you an IDE to help you build more widgets. So yeah, you had to do the first one by hand, obviously. But
yeah,
have you done a lot of the work?
What's that?
So you had to do, but is most of your modern work using the same IDE?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We use the IDE is fully reified, they call it. The IDE is made up of widgets. The debugger, you can debug the debugger using the debugger.
I am stunned. That's why I said this demo. I mean, I was trying to read the text about all this, and I didn't quite get it. Then I watched the demo, and I went, now I don't get how it's even possible.
Well, that's good, I guess. Datafication.
So you reinvented the meta table. You reinvented a file system. You reinvented web serving using event-driven logic that you also invented. You reinvented Git. You reinvented the React framework or whatever. There's a lot of, only about six dozen JavaScript frameworks now. What most inspired you to build the one the way you built it?
That's a great question. I actually wasn't one of the existing JavaScript frameworks, although a lot of them, like the actor model is a strong pattern that we kind of embrace. But it dates back to like the W3C worked on a idea called web components, which were supposed to be these modular reusable components with inputs and outputs. And I don't think their technology is designed quite right, but it was actually a W3C standard that we kind of took some of the best ideas from and adapted to our approach.
Hey, so I wanted to jump in if I could, and
sure.
First off, tell you that I think you're crazy. Just to be honest, listening to you, but it sounds like you've actually made it work. Is AquaMeta actually to the point to where you can build real useful applications with it?
How do I answer that? If I was talking to a production engineer, I would say no. If I was talking to a hobbyist, I would probably say yes. Right now, it is a functional user interface that you can build stuff with, but I wouldn't put my Bitcoins in there at this point, you know. So security is, we're relying on Postgres's security layer, but it hasn't, which is really cool, by the way. But it hasn't, like, security, turning that security on hasn't been, causes a lot of overhead. And at this point, we're just trying to get the concept across that this actually can be a useful user experience and a good user experience, and give programmers the, you know, a light at the end of the tunnel that, like, this might actually be a viable approach, and like that the user interface, the user experience is good. It's better than, you know, typing code in text files. It's just, you know, it's a 0.1 release. It's brand new. It's very recently just functional with all the, like, we started with a feature set, and that feature set has grown and morphed over the years. But now it's to the point where the user experience is hopefully enough to show some light at the end of the tunnel that this is going to work, you know.
So I want to ask this just to kind of drive a point home. WordPress is just a little PHP bootstrap layer on top of a database, isn't it? How is AquaMeta different than any of the other CRMs?
That's a great question. A lot of different ways. Probably a key distinction to highlight would be the capacity for version control. That, you know, when you make changes to WordPress, you're just kind of cowboy coding these changes, and you hit save, and unless you're doing, you know, very regular updates or backups, you don't have baked into it the ability to roll back to a previous version, which means you can screw it up, or when their security fails, you know, you get hacked and you lose everything. And lots of people with WordPress have had these problems. But another distinction would be that ours has a much more robust concept of modularity, that you can, you know, a WordPress plugin is this kind of cobbled together bunch of goop of PHP fragments. And with ours, you can trivially, like, bundle up nicely packaged modular reusable components that do things like for example, a YouTube, or it's a keep alive. So your screen goes to sleep, right? But there's one exception for that, like when your screen is playing a YouTube video, it won't go to sleep, or any other video. And if you want your screen, my friend was trying to build a poker timer that would keep track of the different levels of poker and alert everybody. But it being a website meant that the screen would go to sleep and the timer wouldn't go off and the JavaScript, it would stop. So one of these little modules could be a thing, just like a keep alive module that has in it a little FLV video and a little widget that you can stick on the screen, and you can grab that and pull it in and drop it onto your page. And build up an application made up of all these little components that might have some, you know, might have some functions in the database, might have some schema, might have some weather data or any kind of data really, might have some resources, like say at a slash demo or whatever, and all, you know, pretty much everything that's in the web stack at every single layer can be, pulled together in a single bundle. So it's a very robust platform for reusable components that WordPress can't even come close to. But you can't put schema in a plugin, right? Like that's
right. So I'm curious, AquaMeta. Where does the name come from? You know, it reminds me immediately of TransMeta. You know, the company that Torvalds famously worked for a while. Is there a connection there at all?
I mean, I was a fan of that company and Torvalds, of course. But no, the AquaMeta it came around like a long time ago. I thought of the name, and it came out of kind of the balance between our conscious mind and our fleshy water bodies, like finding a balance that between our conscious side and our animal side or whatever. But it's also like, as you say, the app is very meta, and like the meta-ness of it is very fluid. It's actually fully reified so that it's completely meta. and and there's no seams between the meta and the not meta. It's all just data. So the aqua is kind of the smoothness of it or whatever.
It is. It's an apt name for what you guys have done. We do have a question from the chat room. We have some very smart people listening to us, and sometimes they call us out on stuff. The Andromedon wants to know, are all of the assets stored in the database? I assume he's thinking of pictures, even video, things like that. Does all of that get pushed into the database as well?
Yeah, it does. Postgres is very apt at storing large binaries and that kind of thing. The exception is that we do have a file system for and data wrapper, so that if something is already on the file system and it has to be there, we can query out to the file system using this foreign data wrapper, and it will make something that is on the file system look like it's data. So everything that comes out looks like data. I can say that. But it doesn't necessarily have to be in the database. It can be stored, the one true copy can be stored on the file system and just made to look like relational data. So you can select star from file system dot file where path equals /temp/whatever. And you get back a row that contains the file's permissions and its owner and the content and the path and et cetera, all the file system stuff.
So one of the things that I think about, you know, as being someone that supports some, you know, user facing things, I know this is a point one, but have you guys started thinking about scale? Is this just are we stuck with a single process? Are we stuck to a single server, or have you thought about, you know, being able to scale it up to larger deployments?
Yeah, that's a great question. The short answer is, like, we've thought about it, but it certainly hasn't been the priority. At this point, we've been like hyper focused on the user experience and proof of concept. But Postgres, like, the great thing is we're not reinventing scaling here. Postgres is badass at scaling, you know, the clustering and replication and all that. And I'm not concerned about it at all. We really need to put a connection pooler in front of there, because right now each REST request, each HTTP request opens a new connection, and that, you know, doesn't scale at all. But like, Postgres has really badass connection pooling. You know, there's already lots of ways to do that. I'm not technologically worried about it at all, but it hasn't been the focus, you know, at this point. We're just trying to prove a concept at this point.
So if someone wanted to run this, would it be possible to just go grab some space on like Amazon's RDS, their big database service? Does it work there yet?
Yeah, I haven't tried it. We use it on EC2, Amazon EC2, and you spin up a Docker on one of their, you know, Ubuntu server instances. But thinking through it, I mean, I don't know. The Docker compiles Postgres from scratch, so there may be some compatibility issues there if they have all the right extensions plugged in that we depend on. But I don't know. It's certainly possible, and probably there's very, very small technical hurdles that we can get over, but haven't explored that yet.
Okay, we have one more question from the chat room. The same The Andromedon wants to know, with all of this being SQL, how do you avoid, what do you do to make sure that you don't have SQL injection attacks just all over the place?
Great question. We don't have to worry about SQL injection attacks at all. Because we use Postgres' security layer, which has row level permissions all the way down to the point where if someone wanted to get into the database, there's this great, really cool project called Schemaverse, where this insane Postgres guy like myself made this game that runs entirely in SQL, and users actually PSQL using the command line into the database and are free to play the game using his stored procedures and insert, you know, a new fighter into their army or whatever. And Postgres' security layer solves that. Like someone that's using this essentially has direct access to the database and can do whatever they want to, and Postgres' security layer, like, they actually took Postgres to DEF CON and was like, all right, guys, try to hack this. And it held up, I think, 2 or 3 years it held up, and no one could crack the security layer. SQL injection is a feature in our model.
Awesome. So I'm curious about your background. Clearly, you were, before doing this, even starting working on this, you were a full stack developer with a lot of Postgres experience and clearly a lot of JavaScript experience. But what were you doing for a living before starting this?
Our company has been around for about 8-9 years now. And I started programming when I was 10 on a Commodore 64. It's been kind of my life pretty much. We were doing a warehouse management system in Django with Postgres in the background, which is where I really fell in love with Postgres and started doing all kinds of non-Django stuff with it underneath the hood. We're a consulting firm. It's right now I have 0 employees and just a couple contractors, and a big empty office space that we're about to get kicked out of. we were a consulting company. Did that for years.
But you also I have to say you're fairly opinionated about some things, and I'm wondering if you also have sort of a philosophy background. Are you trained in that?
No, I was really influenced by Tim Berners-Lee in the Semantic Web, his vision of like a linked data. Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of he actually invented the World Wide Web.
Yes.
People laugh about how Al Gore invented the internet, but Tim Berners-Lee actually invented the World Wide Web. Since then, he's been ranting like a crazy person about linked data and the Semantic Web and this idea that like everything can be data and we can represent all our information using data rather than words. And when you do that, like really amazing things happen. And I share that vision very much. This reified data model is very much influenced by RDF, where you create schema using RDF and you create data using RDF. And, that was a big inspiration for this project. I dabble in philosophy. I certainly don't have any training in it, but I consider myself philosophical, I guess. I don't know.
And so what annoys you the most about SQL?
The syntax, probably.
Which is all of it, yes.
the idea of SQL that you are – what it allows, the underlying model of what it allows you to express, I believe to be very beautiful. But the syntax, like this, join this, join this, join this, pounding your fingers away all day is cumbersome and slow. And if you want to do a 6 table join, there's no reason why that can't be 6 clicks across foreign keys with your finger, you know? I love the model, but the syntax is a little cumbersome. Yeah.
And same questions. You spend all day hacking JavaScript as well as everything else. What annoys you the most about JavaScript?
People trying to do things with it that it wasn't really intended to do.
Like you?
No. No, the opposite. Our stuff is really simple. But like trying to make it a robust programming language when it was a scripting language to start with. I mean, you know, giant strides have been made since it's the most popular programming language in the world. We might as well make it a lot better, and there's a lot of room for improvement, and that progress has been steady, but I don't know. We use it in a very simple way that doesn't require, trying to make it an object-oriented language or a prototypical inheritance language or whatever the heck they're doing these days, and just use it as a very simple scripting language where, you're just manipulating the DOM and catching events and piping them to functions and this kind of thing, so... I like JavaScript. I don't know.
It's fine. I was once on a panel back in 99, I think it was, which really dates me. But I was on a panel with Brandon Eich, and the first thing he said out of his mouth was, "I'm sorry about the optional semicolons."
Totally.
Yeah, so it was like
I like Python's like enforced indenting as syntactically relevant. I like that idea a lot. I wish JavaScript had that, but I don't know. It's fine. It does a job. I don't hate it.
So tell me more about the JavaScript bridge that then talks to the database. Do you have two-way data binding?
Yeah, we have had two-way data binding, and then we've refactored stuff, and it might be kind of broken right now, but it's really close. You essentially can grab a piece of data and then like receive events on that data when it changes on the server, and then use that to update your UI and kind of declaratively bind data to user interface components and then have them keep in sync without programmer intervention or whatever.
Cool. One of the things that's really exciting me about Dart and using Angular Dart with Firebase is they have what they call three-way data binding, which is that, you know, your value on your screen is tied directly to the Firebase value, and that can be tied in real time to another web client. Then so basically you get changes here and it changes everywhere in the world. So you have basically like web chats, things like that, and much more rich applications. So when you get this to scale, where you can actually do something like that, will we see even things like that?
Yeah, I mean, that's already baked in. I mean, I guess we already have three-way data binding in the sense that if two clients subscribe to the same table, like to do a chat, you would make a table called chat message, and then everybody would subscribe to inserts on that table. And then whenever anybody inserts, then it goes out to everybody. It's a pub-sub thing, so everybody that wants the update would get it, so... I guess we have three-way data binding. That's cool.
This is exciting. This is very cool. When we're talking also about scaling, one of the things that's interesting about Postgres is that it uses a single separate process for every current action going on. And at some point in every project I've been up, we've been up against the fact that that also means per active login and things like that. Are you finding that limiting at all?
I don't know. It hasn't been the focus at this point. But I know that, I mean, Postgres can process hundreds of thousands of transactions a second, you know. If there's a tool that can handle that level of load, I'm sure Postgres is it, and we can make it work.
Yeah, we had a guy on the show a couple of years ago, I think now, that did a Java translator between the MongoDB wire protocol and Postgres. And he was benchmarking it on same hardware against actual MongoDB implementations. And even though he's translating all the MongoDB wire protocol into Postgres instructions, Postgres was five times as fast on the same hardware. So it's like, it says a lot about how slow MongoDB is.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Yeah, Postgres is pretty amazing. So you just released 0.1. What's in there and where are you headed next?
What's in there is the layers of the stack plus that I had talked about before, plus a user interface that allows us to do some of the stuff that you would need to do to develop an application. And what's next is to finish that user interface, flush out the feature coverage. Mm-hmm. Like I said, there's all these tables underneath the hood in the system, and the user interface. While the user interface is really easy to build, I'm not that, what do they call it in Silicon Valley? Soviet era user interface. Like we're at that level right now, but, basically feature coverage of the user interface to mirror what the backend can already do. So build the UI basically. And our 0.2 release will focus heavily on, UI and security would be the first two big ones. Yeah.
Do you have a sense at this point of when 1.0 is going to be?
No.
Years. It'll get done when it gets done.
I think we're not that far away. These user interfaces are so easy to build, and the back end is already really solid, and so I think that we're on our way to 1.0 with it. Like if we got funded, I'm looking for investors, hint, hint, but, if we got funded, I think we could build, get to 1.0 in like under a year probably.
And where will this, what are the system requirements for running this?
Let's see. So you can run it on Docker, which makes installation really, really easy. You just Docker build or Docker pull the image down from Docker Hub, and then up it goes. You get a Postgres port and a port 80 port or HTTP port. Or you can build it from source, which is a little bit more arduous, but Postgres, Nginx, and then if you want to use the file system layer, so there's a fuse thing in there that fuse makes things that aren't file systems look like file systems, and if you want that feature, which is totally optional, then you can go into the database and LS. You can like grep your database for whatever you want to, and it'll search all the rows and all the tables and all the schemas and so on and so forth. It just mounts it as a directory tree of tables and rows and fields and schemas, I guess. But if you want that, then your system has to support Fuse. But other than that, pretty much Postgres, Nginx, USG, Python, that's about it.
And is the Docker image enough for me to duplicate your demo?
No. The query builder was actually designed. This thing has been refactored like 2 or 3 times, and the query builder was designed against a much older version. We learned a lot from that, and then it needs to be refactored before we can use it against this current version. So it's not vaporware, but it wouldn't install on this version. The architecture has changed quite a bit since then. But pretty much, okay. So the end of our tech demo, that's all exactly from the current build, where you build a little web application with it. But not the query builder and not the Sphere, I don't think. But it won't take much to get that stuff in there. We're also trying to be mildly financially smart about this, and so potentially building like a bundle library, like a bundle hub, where you can exchange these components and have, you know, give them away certainly, and also potentially sell them, that we might be able to use the query builder to sell it for $1 or $2, you know, and make a little bit of money here, keep the lights on.
So the good segue into something I was wondering about, what is the license? What, you know, it's open source. Which license did you choose to build all of this?
We did GPL3.
Mm-hmm. And how much of what you've built is open source? Is everything, is all of your code available, or are there some bits that you're gonna hang on to as proprietary?
Everything is available. The full web stack is available. The only thing that's not available is that grammar pipeline and the query builder. That one we actually filed a provisional patent on. And I'm not a giant fan of software patents, but like, and my strong tendency is not to be financially smart about this stuff. So the vast majority is open source, and that's the way we want to keep it. But yeah, the grammar pipeline is not. So.
Do you have a feel yet for what your business model is going to be when you start to put it together? You know, are you going to offer hosted versions of this or support? Or, you know, you mentioned the idea of selling these bundles as well. What is that business model going to look like?
Yeah, great question. So it's never going to be like a centralized silo of information. I can say that. I'm philosophically opposed to it, and I think a lot of consumers are just kind of over that model. But if people want a hosted version, I suppose we can provide it, but you're encouraged to host it yourself as well. The long play, I would say, is the bundle library. You know, people like providing a platform for people to do commercial endeavors on this thing, as well as open source endeavors. And then, you know, we've got a lot of like our background is in warehouse management and supply chain and that kind of thing. So we've actually got a prototype of a new warehouse management system using this platform that allows us to deploy warehouse management systems that are actually customizable by the users. And I think we can make a lot of money that way. I don't know if we, I've got way too many business ideas to, keep them all in my head. I mean, it's so far upstream that there's a lot of opportunity for a lot of people, hopefully, besides ourselves as well.
Well, you probably have 6 brilliant ideas before breakfast every day, sounds like. Yeah, so I have we have a couple, almost out of time, so I want to get to a couple more questions that I had in my head thinking about this. Yeah. As you're describing that everything is a row in the table, in the database, it reminds me of one of my old friends. Well, he's not old. Well, it's been around a long time. That's what it is. I guess that makes him old. I was an advocate for Smalltalk for many years, and a nice local company, Gemstone, has a product that basically is Smalltalk objects from top to bottom, including having web servers written in CSide and things like that. So this reminds me a lot of that. Are you familiar with Gemstone?
I'm not. No, I've never. I'm familiar with Smalltalk, but not that project. No.
Yeah, that's really interesting because Gemstone is actually they operate the world's largest Smalltalk database because it's distributed, running on 5 continents, to handle all of the cargo container traffic in the world, or 10% of the cargo container traffic. So in that particular instance, you know, an actual container sitting on a ship is mapped into an object sitting in the database. And so everything's built based on transactions around this. It sounds like you could probably do similar things with this and hopefully get it to scale the same way they've been able to do theirs. And yeah, their business model's not open source, but they provide a licensed version for up to 2 processors on a single like web server or something like that. So you could run this for free in that environment, and then you have to pay to get past that. But what's practical about it is you can also distribute that, so you could actually run many, many, many instances of it, and you could actually build up an entire empire using the free version of it. That's called Glass, by the way, Gemstone Linux. I don't remember what the ASS stands for, but you might want to look into that project and see if you can steal some ideas about, you know, because clearly Smalltalk is datafication in its origin.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. They're very self-reifying and all that. That's cool. I'll check into that. Thanks.
Yeah. And they're a local company. They're actually out here in Beaverton. So I worked for them back when they were Serviologic Development Corporation, one of my last actual jobs before I became Stonehenge. So that's how I know them from 20 years ago, actually. I've been doing Smalltalk since 1980. So, yeah, long time. anyway, so a couple more final questions. You say you have a team working on this. Are you looking for outside contributions?
Yeah, absolutely. And the team is very, you know, people have worked on it over the years, but, you know, for pay largely. And right now the open source team is pretty small. We have, like I said, we just did the 0.1 release, which hopefully catches a few crazy people's eyes. And we're very much open to contributors. There's a lot to do. There's a lot of, you know, bug fixing and testing and using and trying to build cool stuff with it and running into problems and, writing documentation and test coverage is not 100% by a long stretch, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, contributors are very welcome. Yeah, absolutely.
And Postgres is getting smarter and smarter with every release. Is there anything that you would hope would be in a future release that would make some of your work easier?
I mean, 4 years ago, I would have said absolutely if they would please add this feature, that would be so amazing. And as like it's almost like just when we need the feature, they just release it. I mean, Postgres is by my view, you know, close to feature complete, other than like nice to haves on the side. It's amazing. It's a profoundly amazing, valuable piece of software. And there's no way that we could have invented this with any other database. And believe me, I've tried. We did it. We tried one in you know, XML databases and RDF databases and MySQL. And over the years, you know, dating back like probably over a decade, I've been trying to build something and it wouldn't be possible without Postgres. I mean, it wasn't possible. And so no, Postgres rocks. I think everybody should be using it.
You actually stole the next question I was going to ask, which is, are you going to port this to MySQL someday? But no, the answer's no.
No.
You're crazy, but not that crazy, right?
it's not possible. There are missing features that wouldn't allow us to do. You could do a partial feature coverage in MySQL, but MySQL doesn't have some of the really amazing features that Postgres has that allowed us to do this. You know, And I could be speaking totally ignorantly, and they might have added it over the years. You know, there's a lot of cool. I used MySQL for years as well, but Postgres has got more cool features. So I don't know that we could do it in MySQL the same thing.
Yeah, I don't think so. Knowing what I know about MySQL, even Maria is only barely better. It has a lot of backward compatibility issues for that, so that's cool. So ultimately, if we get to 1.0, is this going to be, well, if you will, you definitely will get to 1.0. Will this be the kind of thing that I would reach for if I want to make a commercial website and develop it and have, looks like some really nice features and a backed database, all my data is stored in there. So this is the kind of thing that's just will ultimately be very practical, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, the idea is to kind of democratize website development. It's, you know, the web is changing so much of our world, and yet in order to be a producer in it rather than a consumer, you kind of have to have either a lot of money or a lot of skill, and there's a lot more ideas than there are programmers, and there's a big creativity bottleneck, and the idea is to kind of hopefully democratize it to the point where rather than having a, you know, that many manuals, you only need to say that many. It's never going to be, you know, magical and everyone can just suddenly do it. I don't think that's realistic, but making it a lot simpler and making it so that you can do useful things would open up a lot of creativity, I think. So.
And if I'm already, obviously your IDE is beautiful and has a lot of, you know, modern technology in it. But if I'm much more comfortable editing my HTML and JavaScript with, say, IntelliJ or WebStorm or something like that, will there be some way that I can get in and at that HTML and JavaScript in some other text editor?
Yeah, we've got a pretty cool idea around that. So like I was telling you, the file system looks, I mean, we can make the database look like it's a file system. And we haven't done it yet, but the idea there is to do some smart field renaming so that if a file I forgot to talk about the semantics layer where you can decorate a column, say that this is a table that contains JavaScript components, right? There's one column in that table called likely JavaScript, and the semantics layer allows us to decorate that column and say, what's in this column is more than just text. You know, Postgres's type system says this is text. But if it's an email or if it's, say, some JavaScript or if it's, a text file or whatever it might be, like a README, like a MD, a Markdown file or whatever, to automatically tack on that extension on the file system layer so that your text editor can go in there and it automatically thinks it's JavaScript and that kind of thing. And yeah, use whatever IDE you want to. A big part of why, you know, people don't put code in the database is because of that. Because it's just, it's, you know, what do you do with that? Do you, you know, make a code change by writing an update statement? It doesn't really make sense. So we're trying to bridge that gap between developer tools and the database. So it's a positive experience to edit code in the database.
Cool. Like I said, we're almost out of time. Is there anything we didn't ask you yet that you want to make sure our audience is aware of about your project?
No, this has been really probably the best interview I've ever had. And thank you so much, by the way, for the opportunity to come on the show. This is a great platform, and I'll be watching it more in the future for sure.
And what's your biggest call for people to assist you? What kind of people are you looking for?
Investors, but that's, you know, okay. Like, as far as this community goes, contributors, people to try it either as users and have bad experiences, which right now I guarantee you will. but hopefully some good ones too. And also like Postgres hackers that are willing to go in there and help us add features and flesh things out and find all the bugs and squash them and get this thing up to 1.0.
And also... there goes my question. I forgot it already. Oh, I have two final questions I have to ask everybody, especially tech people like you. Sure. So what's your favorite text editor?
I use Vim.
Okay.
Wrong answer.
I'm an Emacs guy. I always have to ask that. Yeah. And what's your favorite scripting language?
Scripting language? I don't know.
I'm guessing Python, right?
We were always a Python dev shop for years. Yep. Yeah, Python's probably my favorite, like, enterprise-grade programming language, yeah.
I was going to say, actually, probably your favorite scripting language now is PLPGSQL, right?
Oh, God, no. Absolutely not.
Oh, man. Hey, this has been really fun. You're doing a really interesting project here, and I hope people step up and help you out. And I'm sure, you know, now that you've had some huge number of earballs and eyeballs exposed to this, people will be contacting you right away, especially after they see that demo. That is just the demo is just outstanding, and I'm glad that's up on your site for that. So good, best of luck to you, and stay inside today, otherwise you're gonna be covered by smoke and ash. And thanks very much for being with us for this hour on Floss Weekly. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks to you guys. Have a great day. I'll talk to you later.
Yeah, thank you. So that was Eric Hansen. Genius. I don't know how best to describe him. Jonathan, what do you think?
I'm not sure I quite have my brain wrapped around what the entirety of his software looks like and what it would be like to work with it. There are several of the little parts that he described that I can't help but think they're amazing, like being able to do versioning on a website and a database. Little things like that, like individual bits of the project, I think are amazing and I want to use. So I still don't think I fully understand what it would be like to work with the entire thing. I may have to actually go check this one out. It's such a different, it's a paradigm shift from what we've done in some ways with things in the past. It's a whole different way of looking at programming and programming the web particularly. But I'm glad someone is out there, you know, asking those questions and trying to figure out what it would look like and, you know, making it work.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons I brought up Gemstone is because it does remind me of what I was excited about having, you know, a distributed Smalltalk database that could power, you know, 10% of the container traffic in the world, that sort of thing, and all the way down to simple websites. So I hope this also gets to the same point using modern quick technology that's all open source, which is really convenient as well. So anyway, we're almost out of time, so let me go ahead and run up the upcoming guests. Next Thursday, normally we're on Wednesdays, but next Thursday we got bumped. It's going to be friendup.cloud, which is desktop OS and a browser tab. Following that, back on Wednesday again for the rest of these, Oracle Open Source. They contacted me and said, hey, we're doing open source now. Well, yeah, they've been destroying enough open source. So let's see. They have a Docker image management system that looks pretty interesting. So we're going to have them come on. The following week, there was a big announcement recently about CNCF, the Cloud Native Something Foundation. Compute Foundation, getting together with the commercial hosting service Packet and actually providing free machines to do your cloud native research on, which is going to be really cool. So we'll have two representatives talking about that. Following that, Live Git 2, which is the embeddable Git core that many tools use. OpenBenchmarking.org, following that, which is where you go for all sorts of, you know, does this Linux hardware run better than that Linux hardware? And is it better in FreeBSD or OpenBSD? That sort of thing. So they've got a bunch of benchmarks on there. We're going to talk to them about that. Following that, Bedrock, which is a distributed database built on SQLite, which is a whole different kind of database. Crail, which is high-performance storage networking. That's all we have on the schedule for now, but if you have other projects that want to be on that list, please have the project leader or the community coordinator email me. If you go to the homepage for this show, twit.tv/floss, you can see the big spreadsheet coming up about what we have, at least people that we're already talking to. My email address is also on that webpage, merlin@stonehenge.com. That's where you send the requests. We have a live stream at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time, usually on Wednesdays. Today is Wednesday, so yeah, usually on Wednesdays. I was thinking about next week. Next week it'll be Thursday, so just trying to fix that. You can follow us on Floss Weekly and Google Plus. Yes, I'm finally posting there again, and that tweets over to @FlossWeekly. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus and also @Merlin on Twitter. I just got back from an exhausting weekend at Dragon Con. That was really, really amazing. I ended up walking, according to my Fitbit, 27 miles. I essentially ran a marathon, and it was amazing. I was on 7 panels, had a great time, gave my talk on why Dart should be your next programming language. The slides for that and the audio will be up for that in about 20 days or so. It may be earlier, but that's all they promise. So that'll be up there. And I also want to thank, in my absence last week, I want to thank Aaron and Simon for a really great job last week with the Hiawatha Web Server show. So that's really great. Next week, I will be at the Open Source Summit in Los Angeles. I've already gotten 4 or 5 requests from that show to be on this show. So that's already paying off, but it also looks like an exhausting 4 days for me, including doing Floss Weekly on Thursday from the hotel there. So hopefully everything will work. Hopefully my hotspot will work fine. Following that, I'm also going to be at allthingsopen.org in Raleigh, North Carolina. If Hurricane Irma doesn't – Irma? I, starts with an I. Irma?
It's
yeah.
Irma.
Yeah. So hopefully it hopefully that won't ruin North Carolina, so helps people to go to the show. Anything you want to plug, Jonathan?
Just a note, we talked about open benchmarking coming up. That we're actually going to talk to Michael Larrabel, who is possibly best well-known for Phoronix.com and the Phoronix test suite, and I'm sure we'll talk to him a little bit about those things as well. Other than that, the big thing I want to not necessarily plug but talk about, we bought a house. So, yay. You know, in the next few months, my background will change and we'll put together another home office and we will move corporate headquarters. So looking forward to that.
Nice. And be sure you stay out of the impending locust invasion, because I'm sure that's the next one after fires yes. and floods and hurricanes and everything else. I don't know. It's frogs coming from the sky. There's going to be some
flaming
weird stuff.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, I could make a political statement, but I'm just not going to go there because it's too easy. That one's too easy. You just imagine what that political statement might be. But OK, anyway, so thanks, Jonathan. And we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.